Hi there, listeners of the Accents podcast on WUKY. This episode is brought to you by Kentucky Humanities and the Kentucky Book Festival. I'm your host, Katerina Stoykova, and my guest today is writer and filmmaker Robbie Hansen. Hi, Robbie, and welcome.
Katerina, thank you so much for inviting me to come on.
What are you busy with these days?
You know, when it gets closer to the summer, our family enterprise is Pioneer Playhouse, which is a 75-year-old summer stock theater that was built so long ago. A lot of the lights are rusty. A lot of the cables, the squirrels chew through them. So what I'm doing is I'm getting the theater ready for the summer season of plays, and it's a lot of work.
Is it a lot of hands-on work?
Oh, gosh, yes. You know, I'm up ladders, down ladders, you know, painting, you know, screw gunning, stapling.
What about the squirrels?
The squirrels, they drive me crazy, you know, because they sort of get into the attics of places. Pioneer Playhouse was built by my father, you know, 60 years ago. He started a theater 75 years ago. But most of it is wood. And so that kind of after 60, 70 years, you know, needs paint, you know, needs replacing planks and that sort of thing.
Well, tell us about the history of that place.
Okay, gladly. My father was born and raised in Danville, Kentucky, but he had a passion for acting and theater. And after World War II, he went to New York City and he studied at the New School acting, along with Harry Belafonte and Tony Curtis. And they were all on the GI Bill, you know, right after World War II. And he loved acting so much that he decided to come back to his hometown of Danville and start a theater. But the only place he could find that had a stage and a presentation stage was the Darnell Mental Hospital. So he started his theater in a mental hospital. And some people think that zaniness has continued for 75 years.
At some point, you and your sisters?
Yes. Our father ran it for, you know, 50 or 60 years. And we even had a sister, Holly Henson, who ran it for a number of years. But both of them passed away. And my sister, Heather, you know, had been a book editor and then a book writer in New York City, and I had been in New York for 16 years and then pursued filmmaking in Los Angeles for another 16 years. So we were away, but Kentucky pulled us back, and the love of this theater that was our family business pulled us back. So Heather and I are, you know, all in on, you know, making this theater work.
Did you always know you're going to be in arts?
Well, when you grow up in a summer stock theater and there's actors from New York City there and, you know, a lot of, you know, strange and interesting and unique people, it kind of hardwires it into your DNA to do something that's not normal, you know. So I think both Heather and I were encouraged, and we are who we are because of where we were born and raised, in a summer stock theater.
When did you start writing?
Well, I first started writing as a screenwriter, and I went to NYU, got a master's degree at NYU in film, and at first I was a documentary filmmaker, and then it took me about 7 or 8 years to sort of shift into doing feature films. And, you know, I've directed 5 feature films, but I've probably written 45 or 50 full-length screenplays. You know, some I was paid for, most I was not paid for. But I think I had a filmmaker's sense of telling a story. And, you know, directors and filmmakers will always say they are storytellers. So when COVID hit, yeah, I said, you know, I've got a book in me. I am going, you know, I can't really get out so much. I'm just going to sit home and, tell a story in the novel form. And so I did that in 2020.
So that was your book?
This is my first novel. Yeah, Loud Water.
I want to ask you first about your relationship with New York City.
Okay. Well, I was there for 16 years, and it was right after I had gone to undergraduate for a year at UK, and then 3 years at Warren Wilson College, which is kind of a hippie school, you know, down there in Asheville, North Carolina. And then right away, I went to NYU, and I moved to New York to go to grad school, and I loved it. You know, my classmate was Ang Lee. You know, the guy in the equipment room was Spike Lee. You know, there was just a lot of energy in, you know, going to school in downtown Manhattan in the 80s. And CBGBs was still going a little bit into the 80s. And so it was a great time.
I'm sorry, what is CBG?
What is CBGBs? You don't know the Talking Head song? This is not a mud club. This ain't no CBGBs. I've got no time for you now. You don't know the Talking Heads?
I know the song and I know the Talking Heads. That
it's about a club in New York City.
Okay.
Katerina. Of course, you didn't grow up in American culture, but it was the birthplace of punk rock and Blondie and new wave music, CBGBs.
Okay.
Jim Jarmusch, you know, was there all the time.
Is it still on?
You know, actually, I think when I flew into Newark, they have a CBGB's knockoff in the airport at Newark, but it's not the same thing. They're trying to capitalize on it. So, okay.
My son left Kentucky, Lexington, Kentucky, to go live in New York City.
Okay.
And so I see that, you know, people go both ways.
Right.
Do you miss it?
New York was like a huge tattoo to my being and my soul. And then when I decided to move to Los Angeles, I just left it cold turkey and I moved to Los Angeles. And I didn't look back, you know. I was like, I did my time in New York for 16 years. And then I did my time in Los Angeles for 16 years. And now I'm back in Kentucky. But I do miss it, but I don't think I want to live there anymore in New York. It's, you know, I think when you're younger, it's a good place.
Tom Martin, the radio personality, I interviewed him years ago on Accents, and he said the following thing: I added 10 years to my life by moving to Kentucky.
Oh, because he just relaxed a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's true, you know. And my sister, Heather, did the same thing. She was a book editor at HarperCollins. And when she had kids, you know, she was like, oh, am I going to be raising kids in New York or will I come back to Kentucky? And one of the main reasons was, you know, I'm going to kind of raise kids in Kentucky was one of her reasons to come back.
You wrote Loud Water during the pandemic.
I should give a thank you to COVID for writing that.
Many a book has that acknowledgement. So talk about writing the book.
Loud Water is a very Kentucky-centric story. It's the story of a badass from Eastern Kentucky who's done everything wrong to this point in his life. And he committed a crime against his family for which there's no forgiveness. And in the darkest place in his existence, he's in prison, he takes up painting and creating art. And he doesn't really understand why he does this, but he kind of just starts doing it. And he also sustained tinnitus from a prison yard fight. And so there's a loud water, you know, like loud water in a creek after a big rain, always in his head. And that's where the title comes from. And he gets out and he goes back to the places where he did bad things before, and some people in his family don't want to ever forgive him. And he doesn't want to talk to people. He just wants to paint. He just wants to, you know, sort of sit in a corner and paint. But he gets pulled back into the sins of the past, and he has to make a choice if he's going to help this drug-using neighbor who lives in the motel, you know, in the room next to him, and her young son. And there's a cost if he decides to help her. And so it's a kind of a, I hope it's a very rooted Kentucky novel, but it's also a little bit of a crime novel, too, you know, mixed in there.
Can you read us a little bit?
Well, Katerina, I think I'll read from chapter 4. This chapter is called Silent Magic, which is what he thinks about a Prius that he sees that doesn't make any noise. the character's name is Crit, and he's still in prison, but he's going before his parole board, and this is dealing with the parole hearing, and then he will be leaving prison shortly after 17 years. Oh, and I will say, besides running a theater, I do have a prison outreach program where I teach writing and performance to incarcerated writers, and I've been doing that for 15 years. And there's a big shout out thank you to my writing circle behind bars, which really influenced, you know, a lot of my feeling for this character, for sure. So, chapter 4, Silent Magic. 18 months later, Crit shaved his beard and trimmed his hair and sat in a molded plastic chair facing a TV monitor and video camera. He hadn't thought much about parole until Sister Nikhail had dug down into the details of his sentence. She informed him he would soon meet his 85 and 10 requirement and he should prep for it. When he asked her what business it was of hers, she answered that Van Gogh had a brother and he needed a sister. She told him that his was a rare talent. She used the word savant, whatever that meant. Apparently, he had an innate and exceptional skill and brilliance. He worked a piece of charcoal like the best poets sling words. Most of what she said flapped past him without landing. So you believe it was your fault? The TV screen before him was divided into three vertical boxes, and each box held an unsmiling parole board officer who looked like a retired bull cop. The video link set up allowed officers of the court to drink coffee and eat donuts in the comfort of their own homes or plywood paneled offices and not drive out to the far-flung corners of the state to give a thumbs up or thumb downs on the sacred hopes and dreams. It was my fault that I chose to take drugs and sell drugs and drink alcohol. He had been coached to look directly at the blinking red light on the video camera by the ball trustee who ran the camera, a tip he found hard to follow. His eyes kept drifting down to his hands in the floor. You completed a SAP program? He nodded and remembered to say yes. I did. It got me to look at myself and my bad habits in a better way. There was a pause. The skin on his face itched. The officer on the left sipped from a coffee mug. The officer on the right was texting on his phone. The officer in the center picked up a piece of paper. We have a letter, a recommendation letter here from Assistant Nikhail to Coven. Can you tell us why she recommended paroling you? She taught some art classes that got me to focus on a new hobby that became more than a hobby. What do you mean? Crit rubbed at the charcoal smudge on the webbing between his thumb and forefinger. Instead of getting into trouble, I pretty much stay to myself and draw and paint. He was asked to speak louder. Instead of getting into trouble, I just draw. What do you draw? It took a moment for Crit to gather an answer. I draw the darkness of things in charcoal, and then the white of the paper, the part that I don't touch, that becomes the light. It happened whippet fast. 36 hours later, Crit stood in the hub with three plastic garbage bags clutched to his chest. He had been told to stand and wait and watch for a signal from the control center officer 100 yards distant, then to start walking. But April winds gusted a dust cloud up from the softball field, and Crit's left eye stung and watered from it. The officer appeared to beckon. Crit blinked cloudiness away to be sure. Free man walking, an inmate behind Crit chirped. He had lived amongst a thousand strangers, but in an unpeopled place. The wind blew and rattled the chain on the flagless flagpole. The ringing in his ears escalated like a sandblaster in his head and pushed up his unease. He walked a steady cadence, right foot, left foot. What troubled Crit Popewell to his marrow core was not that there, beyond the nearing gate, lay sky and clouds and mud so different from the dark mud he had wallowed in for nearly 14 years. Nor was he trembling before an unknown future. He had no future. This he knew without any doubt. What he felt now was each propulsive and trembling stride forward carried him backward into his own defeated, dreaded, and worthless past.
Wow, Robbie. I could picture everything. It is so cinematic.
Well, I just spent a lot of years as a filmmaker, so yeah.
So are you going to write a screenplay around this?
Well, this developed as a screenplay idea a couple of years before COVID, and then I decided to turn it into a novel. And there is a screenplay version, but I'm sort of sitting, we'll see if that takes off, you know.
So do you write plays besides screenplays also?
I do write plays, and my plays have been presented mainly at Pioneer Playhouse, because when you own a theater, it's easy for them to do your plays.
Well, you can basically write the plays for the venue.
Well, we do. So I did a big silly comedy about a mashup of Elvis Presley and an Agatha Christie murder mystery as a crowd pleaser. But I was very pleased. I did a play several years ago, about 4 or 5 years ago, called Good Blues Tonight, that celebrated the African-American community in Danville that got sort of bulldozed over by urban renewal. And that was moved to the Lyric Theater and was performed here in Lexington at the Lyric Theater. And that was about 4 or 5 years ago, I think. So I do write some plays.
Making documentaries. What makes you interested in a subject enough that you want to explore it on film? I mean, what makes you say, this will make a great documentary?
You know, when I got out of film school, that's what I did for about 8 or 10 years, was make documentary films. And you're right, Katerina, you really have to really love your subject to stick with it for a year or two, if not more, you know, to... and you're making up the story in the edit room with documentary. You know, the narrative process is very interesting in filmmaking and in novel creation, based on, you know, the first novel that I wrote. Documentary, you shoot a lot of stuff and you kind of just figure out your story in the edit room, but you have to feel that there's something about your subject that would be worthy of having a narrative made of it in the edit room, you know. And probably one of my favorite documentaries was about the 1919 Corbin riot, and it was called Trouble Behind, and it's on, you know, YouTube with like a million views so far. And that film got into Sundance, but it explores the history and impact of a 1919 race riot on the community of Corbin, Kentucky. And I did that in the early 90s. And so, you know, that was a subject I was drawn to. When I just got out of film school, I actually was drawn to making a documentary about Happy Chandler, who was an illustrious governor and singer of my old Kentucky home. And so I did a film about him that's also on YouTube. Now,
do you act?
No, I'm a little too nervous to sort of be in front of an audience, you know, trying to put something over for them.
But you do play the guitar.
I do play the guitar, and my mother was an amazing singer. That gene did not get passed to me, so you know I will play guitar and sing, but I don't think you'd want to hear it.
Do you write songs?
Yeah, I have. I think everybody who plays guitar has written some songs.
But... So what other talents do you have that I'm not asking about?
I have motorcycles. And I'm actually really good as a carpenter, and I'm pretty good as an electrician, and I'm pretty good as a plumber. And, you know, I grew up doing those things, and so our friend Erin Chandler, I helped put in a shower at her place, you know, so.
Do you cook? Do you garden?
Gosh, no, I'm not a, I don't have the patience for cooking or gardening. I kind of stay, you know, on the front foot busy a lot, maybe too much, maybe I'm too busy.
Is there such thing? What are the signs if you're too busy?
Well, I know I'm too busy now because I'm getting our theater ready for our Pioneer Playhouse summer season. And I get up at 6:30 in the morning and I'm like, am I going to wear clean clothes for 2 hours and change to my dirty clothes to work in? Or do I just go to my coffee shop in my dirty clothes, but I'm getting up early, I'm working late. A lot of it is going up ladders, you know, building sets, hanging lights, and I'm 66 years old and I'm feeling like I get tired from doing all this stuff.
And what are you writing?
I have had to stop writing because of putting the theater together for the summer. But I'm kind of doing a historical novel set in Kentucky in 1920 during Prohibition, 1927, loosely based on my grandfather on my father's side, who was a Prohibition agent in Kentucky. So I don't know if it will work as a novel, but I'm sort of, you know, on page 50.
That's it's a critical place.
It's a critical place. Yeah. You know, I have an outline and I'm on page 50, but I put it down and pick it up and put it down and pick it up. Yeah.
Maybe after you open the season and things settle down a little bit.
I hope so. I can't say that I'm any kind of expert about writing a novel, but it was different than writing a screenplay, and I kind of enjoyed the process. The writers that I kind of appreciated, the novelists that I appreciated, I could kind of feel what their characters were thinking and experiencing, and so I was hoping I was doing that with my main character, Crit, in Loud Water. And it's kind of different than writing a screenplay, which is kind of an outline of a narrative. And in a novel, you kind of have to go perhaps deeper, or you have to go sustain longer inner kind of thinking and monologues and that kind of thing. So it's different, you know, writing the novel. Film is kind of about the impactful moments. You know, I have to orchestrate an impactful moment, then go on to another impactful moment, then go to another impactful moment. And my experience is limited as it is with the novel. You kind of give the characters time to breathe. But because I'm a filmmaker, I try not to put anybody to sleep, you know, even if the character's walking across the street to, you know, get something to eat at the 7-Eleven, you know. How can that be interesting, you know, to the reader to go into a 7-Eleven and, you know, buy some, you know, some saltine crackers and Cheese Whiz?
Do you have any plans for another film?
Well, I'm 66, and I think film, the powers that be kind of tilt younger, you know, for, you know, giving money and fun. You know, film is all about the funding. You know, we talk about, well, what's the difference between writing a book and making a film? Well, one of the things is money. You know, film is so expensive. So how are you going to get that money? And if you're Steven Spielberg and you've reached a certain level of success, then that's easy to get the money. But
I think even if he's 120, somebody will give him money.
Somebody will give him money. Yeah, I think so. But, I never reached that kind of level of filmmaking success. So it's a bit of a scramble always to get funding. And it just seems like a hard mountain to climb, you know, to get the funding, you know, in this day and age.
Well, that's my other question. With all this technology, is making movies becoming more expensive or less expensive?
Well, you know, I teach film classes at UK. Okay. And, you know, I will say to my students, it's the best of time and worst of time. The best of time is that the technology makes it cheaper. And, you know, their phone is, you know, a 4K, you know, a shooting instrument. And then, the technology is cheaper. But, you know, the cheaper technology has led to kind of a flood of product. And so it's harder to make money with just an okay film. Mm-hmm. Now, if your film is the diamond or the needle in the haystack that gets pulled out and goes to Sundance, you'll do fine and you'll always do fine. But for films that are sort of okay and just okay, I think it's harder for those films to make the money that they did make 20 and 30 years ago. But so I tell my students, this is the best of time and worst of time. Go make films. It might be a little bit harder now to get paid for it.
So when I read the book, especially if it's poetry, within a poem, and I rarely need a second one, I can kind of tell if the person has, you know, has the chops. Hmm. What about you with watching movies?
Yeah, you know, and I see so many good things on Netflix now, or I think, you know, I might call it the production value or the look of the film. I think we're going through a period where most series on Netflix look really good, but yeah, you can always tell if you're interested, you know.
Like, looking good doesn't really...
Well, for me, if it sets a sense of place, if you kind of feel the characters or an authentic... situation or an authentic looking backdrop, that impacts me when I'm watching the film, you know, as opposed to if it's, you know, student cinema, white walls, and looks like it was shot in their dorm, you know. I mean, that's a bad example of, we all think that that's...
Are you able to predict what's going to happen?
In movies?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, probably more so than most people, but I'm always surprised, you know. And I think any today, as you know, like I was watching the Netflix series Eve, you know, and they do the thing where you think they're going to kill this person, but then they surprise the audience by swiping the gun over there and kill the other person. That's kind of a cliche in itself to do the, you know, set up for this, switch to that. Yeah. I think, you know, there are certain rules of screenwriting about setups and payoffs, and I think, you know, we can see those coming.
So there is a question that I ask all my guests who teach creative writing, and I'm going to ask you as a guest who teaches film, who teaches film. So what is the most important thing you teach your students if you want them to remember one thing from your workshop?
You know, I have some good maxims. You know, like, let your small victories lead to bigger victories. You know, do small things well, then maybe that gets applauded, and maybe that applause helps you move on to, you know, a bigger applause. I'm always haunted by whether I should correct them a lot or inspire them a lot. And because I'm a storytelling guy, I tend to want to get them to tell a more impactful story than sometimes they, you know, will do in the first draft. Or should I forget all about that and just say, you know, what I really liked was the brick on the porch and the door of the porch, and that was great, and, you know, maybe the rest of it wasn't so great, but you go. So, you know, what do you think? Should we inspire, or should we be more critical?
I think that we should encourage people by being honest with them in a way that does not break their wings.
Yeah. And I try to do that. I'm actually a pretty easy teacher, you know. It's easy to get A's out of me, you know. Most of my class gets A's and B's. Because it's creative, you know, I teach screenwriting and, you know, how it's a creative endeavor. And if it's not a world-class screenplay, at least they finish their first screenplay, you know. So.
Well, that is an accomplishment for sure.
Yeah.
Well, good luck with the Pioneer Playhouse, with the new novel. What is it called?
The new one?
The new one?
The new one is called Cruel Daddy.
Cruel Daddy, wow.
Which was the name the bootleggers actually did give to my grandfather. They called him Cruel Daddy.
That sounds fascinating in all sorts of ways. Thank you so much, Roy.
Katerina, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure sitting here in this wonderful older building of the Kentucky Humanities Council and having this conversation with you.